It was one thing when we were trying to replicate Argentina, but to put an Italian in charge of the BLS is a bridge too far, I think.
Yeah, I'm not thrilled about the choice. Heritage Foundation economist.
I thought you had to know how to read to be an economist.
You would be shocked at what you can be handed in terms of degrees if you're willing to schmooze the right people these days.
He's a Saluki. He's a Northern Illinois University guy.
Southern Illinois. And the only way anyone ever knows who the Salukis are is because of the NCAA basketball tournament, of course.
Well, no, didn't Tony Romo go there?
Did he really? No way.
Was it Southern Illinois or Eastern Illinois?
I'm wrong anyway. He went to Northern Illinois, which is not the Salukis. I don't know if they're the...
Oh, that fake team they got up there.
The Salukis are what they do.
Eastern Illinois for Tony Romo.
The last time I heard about Northern Illinois was we played them in the Orange Bowl in 2012, and they had gone undefeated. And they said their players talked a whole bunch of shit before the game and said they were going to have us on our knees by the third quarter. And we wound up winning by like four touchdowns, like pulled the starters midway through the third, that kind of thing. I think their quarterback died. haven't heard anything from him since.
Yeah, that's about on brand. This is Normal Men, a podcast from four men who are clinging desperately to normalcy in an era when that's asking a bit too much. I'm George in Charlotte.
This is Proctor Malone in Washington, D.C.
I'm low-tech speedrun enjoyer in outer Florida.
I'm Ed from Boston.
Danger psychotic.
Well, yeah, I've read Beowulf.
Yeah. I thought, they've started a program in Denmark where they are asking people to bring their pets to the zoo, pets that they do not want anymore if they're old or something like that. Bring them to the zoo so that Danes can feed your cat to the lions. This is apparently a normal thing over there. A couple years earlier in some town called, I think it's Aalborg or something, one of their giraffes was killed in front of a whole bunch of like families and stuff. And those families willingly went, brought their kids and everything. It was great.
What?
So this is like a spectator sport.
Yes. This is a spectator sport for these weird little swamp Germans.
I'm pretty sure they're taller than you are, like on average.
Probably.
And most people, really.
Statistically speaking.
Yeah. I'm exactly average height.
In this country,
yes. So anyway, they kill this giraffe in front of all these families, and then they feed it to their lions and turn it into, as Proctor said, a spectator sport. This is what happens when you are a country where people eat rotten fish as a part of their normal diet and stuff. This is not something we should be doing. These are psychotic people who we should kick out of NATO.
We should Wait a tell- minute. What do you have against Minnesota?
We should kick Minnesota out of NATO.
Yeah, we should kick Minnesota out of NATO.
Or at least the American League.
Minnesota's amazing, right? Because these people leave Scandinavia and they get over here to the New World and they're like, you know, you land in New England or the Mid-Atlantic or wherever, and they're just like, no, it's not miserably cold enough. And they just start marching inland until they reach Minnesota.
They're like, we'll stay here. This is fine.
And Minnesota really is the best case scenario in that part of the country. I mean, you don't have very far to go before you're tipped into the Dakotas.
But that's Plains country. That's not really a direct parallel to the Scandinavia, right? Like,
I mean, some of them did go to the Dakotas, right?
Yeah. I mean, the entire northern tier is all Scandinavians. Some Germans. Yeah. But
poor bastards.
Yeah.
Isn't lutefisk the state dish of North Dakota or something?
I'm not going to fact check that. I'm just going to accept it's true.
Just assume it's true.
It feels right.
I really appreciate that we haven't stuck with that kind of like geographical determinism in terms of later waves of immigration. So like one of the big immigrant populations in Minnesota today is the Hmong. And that's a real different biome, right? Like you're going from Southeast Asia to Minnesota. And surprise, surprise, America has worked its magic. The Hmong in Minnesota play hockey and make hot dish, and they're, you know, they're American kids.
We made hot dish one time, the Amy Klobuchar's recipe for it. That was the saddest goddamn thing I've ever eaten in my life.
Yeah, it came from Amy Klobuchar. Like, come on.
And I've lived in England.
The whole chain migration thing is definitely fascinating, but I think it really illustrates how we've shifted from a geographic, cultural, and political valence to a urban versus rural one, like a modal one. Because 200 years ago, it was the single most important thing was that geographic spread of the hearth colonies on the East Coast West, and also the different immigrant communities that followed them in. Germans in the Midwest is a big example, Scandinavians in the Northeast, et cetera, or in the upper Midwest, et cetera. But now those big immigrant communities, with some exceptions related to agriculture, are drawn to urban places because that's where the opportunity is. I mean, that you don't, that's where there's infrastructure to support a large wave of new arrivals and jobs that they can participate in, and eventually networks they can build. And the Hmong in Minnesota is a perfect example of that, right? And the rural parts of this country just don't have the infrastructure for it. So you don't get that same influx, and you don't get that same exposure to immigrant communities that are so present in any major urban area in this country. There's like 1,000 examples of this kind of thing.
Right, which ends up being, you know, a de-radicalizing force.
Yep.
It sure helped me going to college, I'll say that. Right? Like, I grew up in the middle of nowhere. And
Ed is from Maine.
Very from Maine.
Wait, which part of Maine are you from?
Like western, the tourist trap. Like western-ish Maine near the New Hampshire border. You go over the border to not pay sales tax type of place.
Oh, okay.
4,000 people in the winter and like 25,000 in the summer, something like that. One of those places. But yeah, I mean, I went to a school, I think 200 kids, maybe fewer. I think, yeah, like 120, 130 kids in my graduating class. There was one black kid and he was adopted. So like it was rather monochromatic. And yeah, college was really good. You know, turns out getting away from that, finding a little opportunity for perspective kind of helps.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had the exact same experience. I mean, growing up, small town in Western Canada, about as white as you get. And I thankfully was aware of that and was like, nah, I got to go somewhere different, man. And North Carolina is real different. I'm happy for that. But it's amazing that feeling you get walking into a completely new cultural experience. Where
I gotta go somewhere different. Where are you gonna go? Oh, Duke.
No, but when I first one of the first memories I have of being on campus is walking into the locker room of, because I walked onto the team before I'd even gotten to campus, and I walk into the locker room and I'm just like, oh man, this culturally is not like where I'm from. This is not the same vibes. And it was great. It was wonderful. It was absolutely formative experience.
They couldn't get rid of you.
What did you say to me?
They couldn't get rid of you.
Yeah, they tried.
So I'm spitballing here, George, but do you think that the transition from this kind of geographical affinity migration to chain migration, is that in part a product of a move away from a resource extraction economy to a more urbanized economy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of it. I think there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. I think the modes of economic production, really not even resource extraction so much as agriculture to urban, right? And it took a long time for it to break down, because if you look at, for instance, the election in 1976, when, I mean, the U.S. had been urbanized for 30 years at that point, right? But it still looked like the old geographic breakdown. Reagan was a sort of a giant tide that swept everything, so that doesn't work. But even Clinton, I mean, Clinton won Arkansas, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that was legacy New Deal stuff that was part of a broad geographic coalition driven by regional geography, not by the urban-rural divide. But then by the time you get into the 2000s, it starts to break down. And, you know, farming hasn't been the biggest employer in this country in a long ass time, and very different drivers culturally and economically than we used to have. Anyhow, if this sort of line of thinking is interesting for you, I've got a book for you.
Is it Albion Seed?
It is Albion Seed. Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately. Unfortunately.
Anyway, it's good that we didn't let Danes into this country. We let some Norwegians in, but the Danes.
Bad news for you.
Yeah, not good there.
I don't care. I'm pretending they're Norwegians.
One could say they were here first.
No, that was Canada. It wasn't here.
No, they made it all the way down to the Eastern Seaboard. I mean, we don't have like hard archaeological evidence for it, but
yeah, see, no, you don't have hard archaeological evidence for it. It doesn't count. There's the one longhouse in that dumpy place in Nova Scotia or something.
Are you talking about Lancelot Meadow?
Maybe, I don't know.
And isn't that in Newfoundland?
I don't know Canadian geography. I can't keep up with all your stupid little provinces.
There's no major junior hockey league team up there. I have no idea. See, they laugh. I don't.
Hey, Charlotte's own Checkers were in the, I don't know what league it is because who knows, but they were in the national championship series for that this year. They
AHL,
lost,
I think,
to Abbotsford, I think, if I remember correctly.
I'm pretty sure that would be the AHL, but I also can't be bothered to look because the AHL is fake hockey.
Abbotsford?
Yep.
Where they the hell is
literally
that?
Anyone a team.
Vancouver's lower mainland. It's like in the belt of farms east of Vancouver.
Okay.
Do they riot when they lose too?
No, that's reserved for the Stanley Cup. That's just the Canucks fans when they lose, which is
Calder Cup? No.
No, that actually, those riots, the first iteration of those riots back in 1995, I think it was, would have been, early 1995, maybe not early 1994. Anyhow, Vancouver lost the Stanley Cup, massive riots. And when I'm saying riots, I'm talking about like every storefront broken, cars on fire, people like just proper riots.
Like full on Los Angeles NBA Finals riots.
Philly could take some notes, like that level of like we are destroying the town over a sports ball. And those riots were one of the reasons that my parents were like, yeah, we're out of here. We're moving up to the town I grew up in because the riots were so bad from the Stanley Cup.
Philly's was pretty tame after the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I mean, you grease enough poles and it kind of keeps a lid on things.
Yeah, I mean, they're sad up there.
They ran out of batteries a long time ago, Lotax.
Yeah. And their sports hero is a fictional character.
Santa Claus still hasn't been back.
Yep.
Oh, I bet they've... Yeah, there's a
depot. You never know when it's going to happen. It might sneak up. Somebody might have the best game of their life and a bunch of people... you got to be ready to grease the pole anytime in that city.
Don't trust a group of people who turn dumpsters into swimming pools, is what I always say.
On the topic of unlikely transitions from one thing to another, we were all very intrigued by the Financial Times using Bumble as an in to the alt-right and the Curtis Yarvin and the Mar-a-Lago scene.
The FT article, the person that wrote this was Joanna McKelly, who is an interesting figure at the FT. Her writing is entertaining. She's a good writer, straight up. It's enjoyable to read. And the piece in question here did have a little bit of sort of gonzo type flavor. Like you could almost, she has a different voice than Hunter S. Thompson, to be very clear, but you could kind of get that little soissons of like dipping into the edge of fiction from it. I don't think she fictionalized anything in this, to be clear. This is not a criticism, but that sort of narrativization by joining the party, it was throughout this and it made it just really fun to read. She's got a pretty long history at the FT and is widely read there. And her sort of, there's some themes that come through. One of them is like, she's a classical liberal, right? Like she's concerned about both intolerance of opinion on the left and the same thing happening on the right. And this is like something she's written numerous columns about. It's not like a, you know, throwaway line or whatever. I think we all have a certain set of opinions about one side of that equation, but hey, whatever, at least she's saying it about both sides. And she also has interviewed some people adjacent to the alt-right before. So for instance, she did Lunch at the FT, which if you've never read Lunch at the FT, I highly recommend it. Get a gift link to one or something. You don't have to subscribe to the whole thing for that because it's an expensive paper, but Lunch at the FT is hilarious because they do these very straight, you know, interviews that turn into a self-referential parody about half the time, either of the person that they're interviewing or of themselves. And it's just this great cultural snapshot of like what London media culture is kind of like and how these people think, and very entertaining. So she did Lunch at the FT with Barry Weiss of the Free Press fame. The premise of the article is that she matched with an unnamed person, but someone very close to Curtis Yarvin, who we'll get into, and went to a garden party with him and talked to some extremely strange and brain damaged people. And quite frankly, I made it clear to them as she was talking to them that she thought they were pretty strange and brain damaged people, which made the article that much better.
Well, a lot of them will agree, but that one of the fascinating things about this cul-de-sac of morons is that they all think it applies to everyone else and not themselves. I have had some interactions with this crowd. We'll get into that later. And it's the density is off the charts. You cannot mock them in a way they can recognize.
Apparently Yarvin was chatting up Robert Skidelsky, he's an economic historian over in Britain. He's best known for his biography of John Maynard Keynes, which was, I think, like 17 volumes or something. But the idea of poor Robert Skidelsky, who is 86 years old, having to sit there and suffer brainworms from Curtis Yarvin that's cruelty.
Being willing to sit there means you deserve it.
Does he really have a choice, though? I mean, the man's 86 years old.
He got feet?
Again, 86 years old. I don't know. Mobility may be an issue.
I mean, fair. Buy a gun? I don't know.
Not in the UK, buddy. You get a knife.
That's true. No ninja swords either.
No ninja swords. That's right.
Which is unfortunate because at that age, you might want the reach.
So who is Curtis Yarvin? Who is this person? I think we need to sort of do some backstory here. We've talked about Jemima Kelly, who wrote the piece. Curtis Yarvin is probably the foremost intellectual pillar of whatever we're calling the alt-right now.
No, he's not.
Well,
I'm sorry. No, he's not.
When I say foremost intellectual pillar, I don't mean that in a term of respect, but I mean
no,
that.
No, I understand, but at the same time, I'm like, have you read any of his thoughts?
I have, and they're just
they're fascinating in the same way that I don't know, looking at a car crash is like geometrically interesting.
Yeah. Or how like feeding a giraffe to a lion. When I say foremost intellectual pillar, I mean like he is the person that everyone reads, and his ideas are propagated widely and have been at the leading edge of what they're doing. Not that there are any good or even well expressed or anything like that.
Yeah, let's zoom out for a second. Curtis Yarvin, who was until recently perhaps better known under his pen name, Mencius Moldbug, has been someone who essentially blogged himself into intellectual prominence. He has been writing online, on the internet, wherever, for a long time, back into the 90s, maybe back further than that. And he is a reactionary thinker who has, for whatever reason, found purchase with some of the leading lights, particularly the Peter Thiel crew, of the modern right reactionary movement.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not sure he's the intellectual pillar of the alt-right entirely, but certainly he's a leading voice among the sort of neo-reactionary Silicon Valley right.
He's the kind of person that J.D. Vance reads with enthusiasm, right? And that Peter Thiel reads, and that
right
can put together a garden party in the UK when he's over there for his annual jaunt for a cryptocurrency party. I mean,
so J.D. Vance reads him because he writes at a fourth grade level. People like Peter Thiel just like him because he washes it for other people, right? Like, the thing about Yarvin, and full disclosure, I have some history with these people. Nothing interesting aside from regretting I didn't push someone off a rooftop once when I had the chance. But, like, no, that one's real, folks.
Wow.
Yeah. No, we could have had a fascinating different timeline. I apologize. Anyway, but yeah, like, folks like Yarvin, so he comes out of software because, of course, all of these dirtbags do. He is mostly known in the software space for creating an impenetrable runtime for a computer that can't exist, to run an impenetrable programming language that can't exist, to run a stupid operating system that, of course, eventually goes into crypto. Currency, not Gruffy. It's all Ethereum bullshit at the end of the day. But, like, the thing about it is that he is a master of sounding profound and just being a dumb shit. Like, everything you will ever read out of this guy. And congratulations, you found the one topic I care about. Good job. The thing about Moldbug is that he picks ideas to be as rancid as possible without any real idea of whether they make any, you know, self-consistency. Nah, fuck it. The guy is just he is a troll of trolls, right? Like, and he always has been, right? He used to get thrown out of tech events and then, you know, do the victim game because of everything else he does, right? Like, the fact that he created an operating system that is functionally racist. And, like, at that point, you're sitting over here going, what is going on? What are these dudes doing?
How do you even achieve that?
Because it is so, like, Urbit is a snapshot of the rusted, broken plumbing that is this guy's brain. Like, you can't separate Urbit from him. And so, like, he started getting uninvited from things talking about Urbit, which could potentially be interesting if you were like that.
Urbit is Yarvin's opus. It's his programming language that we're discussing.
No,
is it the OS?
Urbit is the operating system, my which mistake. Is on top. What is the order? I can't even remember because they're all fake names. But they're all just, like, they're perverse. They're perverse in the way that, like, a good joke could be, like, anti-reality if they had a sense of humor. Instead, it's just them being tedious, pedantic, and making things different for the sake of being different so they can pretend that everyone who doesn't get it is just a moron. It's just how they've always been. Sorry, I could go on about this all day. I'll shut up. But there is one thing I would note. If you start looking into the space, it's really hard to not also mention Nick Land, because Curtis Yarvin basically stole all of his moves from Nick Land. And Nick Land is, I'm sorry, I'm going to say a very terrible word here, British. And the look on George's face, incredible. But yeah, like, there is a whole pile of this stuff. And it's telling that, like, this garden party happened in the UK because it's where all of them live. And, right, like, they are absolutely in bed with whatever is now BNP. I forget which mutant is currently getting the votes. But yeah, like, Nick Land is one worth looking at. But
I will say, I learned, I think, three or four new ultra right-wing British conservative movements, British conservative political parties, or reactionary, maybe not even conservative is the right way to describe it, in this article, because there was so much flotsam and jetsam at this event that Kelly went to. And
I think it got all on about, what was it, Homeland now? I think that's the new one. I don't know.
Homeland makes an appearance, absolutely. A fellow named Callum Barker is one of the guests at the party, as well as the national media officer for Homeland, Alec Cave. This gentleman was employed at a place called Open University and got shown the door because he tweeted, "Why does a person who speaks and acts like a foreigner expect to be treated the same as an Englishman in England?"
Oh, sorry, this guy. Is Homeland is a political party?
Yeah, we're not talking about the TV show.
We're not talking about the TV show. Okay.
No.
Fair and shot. Not Homefront. That's a video game. George would know what it was.
You're right. No idea what that is.
I've never heard of the Homeland Party. I've heard of the English Democrats, and obviously I've heard of Reform. Those are typically the two big name reactionary parties over there.
Oh, actually, there was another Homeland person there, Kenny Smith, the party leader. He had been thrown out of the British National Party. I'm not sure what the circumstances now are. But I'm
NBAO and TNT stops and people go weird places.
Yeah.
God, do you know how much of a shitbag you have to be to get thrown out of the BNP?
I don't. I can't even imagine. Yeah. So what, the guy that hosts the garden party in this, and where I'm going to relay the story. It's kind of disturbing in imagery. So, you know, if you have sensitivity towards that, skip ahead a few minutes. The guy that hosts the garden party, really interesting guy for a period of time. He was sort of always at the advent of whatever new music scene was popping up in London, and he organized clubs and whatever. And he was involved in organizing organizing the Pride Parade in Brighton in 1997. And he had this idea because he was concerned with how corporate Pride was getting, you know, rainbow washing or however you want to describe it, which I think is actually a legitimate problem in or legitimate point of discussion. But the way he decided to make this point sort of overshot. So I said, we should have an open top bus, rainbow bus, of course, with gay, gay, gay down the side of it. And 50 people in rainbow Ku Klux Klan outfits waving from the top like gay, gay, gay instead of KKK.
This is what Brighton,
passes for humor.
Yeah. This is in Brighton, England.
Yes. Brighton, as in Brighton Beach, which, by the way, if you're into this sort of stuff, Fatboy Slim, Norman Cook, has some amazing sets from Brighton Beach. But anyhow, this led to his quote-unquote social ostracism, et cetera. And it's just like such a perfect snapshot of how pathetic these people are. Like, buddy, you had a really, really bad idea and people didn't like it. And you stopped getting invited to the same meetups at bars or whatever. And you're reacting to this by becoming essentially a Nazi?
Yeah, it's a terrible idea. And also, of all the cities in Britain to do that in, like, I've been to Brighton. It's a lovely city. Brighton is like one of the most liberal cities in Britain. Like, I think it's run by the Green Party at the council level. So not a group of people that's going to really fly with.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think that story is very indicative of the kind of intellects we're dealing with here. And Ed, you're exactly right to describe Yarvin as just a straightforward troll. That's all he is. His intellectual contributions are a joke, really. But just because they're a joke doesn't mean they're not important and widely read important in the sense of a lot of people care about them and they've gained purchase. And that doesn't make him an intellectually accomplished thinker. He's just a guy who tells people what they want to hear in a certain sense. And Peter Thiel really does want to hear that there should be a king who can just go out and execute people. And he should be that king, by the way.
So I'm going to be real. One of the things that is really important about this, and you kind of touched on this, I think, George, but one of the things a lot of people seem to think is that Yarvin is like some kind of whisperer to the billionaires. No, they think this already. He's just figuring out what to say back to them. Totally. Right? Like he is the suck up at the bottom of the group chat. And the fact that he is in those group chats is fascinating because he is, as far as I know, failed at every job he ever had. But so I in the meritocracy of Silicon Valley, I'm a little surprised that such things can happen. Surely they wouldn't lie to me. Whoops, sorry, tangent. But yeah, like the thing that I think really does come through in that piece that I really like is that there is I've never read this author before, so this was the first time, and rarely have I seen someone capture just how sweaty these people are. Both like physically and spiritually.
So you say that actually Jemima Kelly also has multiple pieces where she's done dispatches from Mar-a-Lago. And I think that character set gets a lot sweatier, both because it's instead of, where was this? Kent? I don't know. It both because instead of the rural UK, it was set in Mar-a-Lago. And also because, I mean, gammon is the term for the UK. The United States takes that gammon term and steps it up another notch. We are talking some very large, very red, very sweaty men.
I don't know. Have you ever watched BBC Question Time? They get pretty large, sweaty, and red on there.
Respectfully, large, sweaty, red men is the one thing those Brits will never be able to top us on. They try. It's cute, but they're not going to get there.
I've simply prestiged to magenta, as everyone in this call can tell. But yeah, the one thing that it didn't catch, though, and like this is one of, I think you have to be deeper in that space to sort of get it, is that, and it bothers me every time this comes up. This is part of why I get a little unhinged on this, is just how, so the author very clearly thinks they're losers. Granted, no idea how much, like, what the magnitude of loserdom we're dealing with here is. Like, you have to spend a lot of time in certain parts of San Francisco to get that. And, like, these are people who in the year of our Lord, well, 2024 at the time, have quote-unquote puddle parties where, you know, they all just take drugs and talk about what they think philosophy is.
I remember freshman year.
These are adults, George.
Yeah. Well, technically, I mean, so are the freshmen, but most of them.
That is the most technically correct thing you've ever said in your life. But, like, no, like, it's a tedium factory. And the fact that it is leaking out just to pervert the politics in which we are forced to live offends me at a personal level. And like, it's good to get more eyes on people like this because, you know, When did you all, except maybe Propter, because Propter's like that, when did you all first become acquainted with Curtis Yarvin?
2010s at some point, probably 2015. Yeah,
probably around then.
You're too online.
I'm very online, sir.
You should know that.
Oh, but, no, there's no denying that all four of us on here have extreme online brain damage.
Yes, but I was expecting like 2018. Because I have been dealing with this moron's mental detritus since like 2008. Yeah, he's been around forever. He is also part of the Neolithic internet. He's just louder and worse. But like that leaking out being the part of all of this stuff that escaped, like at first I thought it was going to be, if not the good parts, the okay parts. They gave Ezra Klein a job at the New York Times. And, like, he is not by any means the same political valence, but he comes out of that same sort of era. He's a couple tide pools over. The tide pool with, like, a nice green lawn and, you know, fewer open head wounds. But, like, like, for a while we got to have that, and now instead it's just this. I rarely know how to even cope with it. Because, folks, this guy cites a guy who calls himself Bronze Age Pervert. Online. And he does it unflinchingly. He does it when he is talking with a microphone in his hand. It's not just like he says it online.
To your point about these guys out in the Bay Area just sitting around doing drugs and talking about what they think philosophy is, the problem is these guys have run out of things to do. Mm-hmm. They haven't had anything to do since the iPhone boom. And they've been hunting for the new big thing ever since. And what I'm saying is the government needs to start subsidizing the Vision Pro and start subsidizing game studios. Like, we have to give them, these are little treats for engineers. And
okay, so keep them busy. In fairness, the problem is usually not the software engineers. Usually, this comes from the product side of the world, Mr. Speedrun Enjoyer. Like, yeah, sure, a lot of them have CS degrees, but come on, these are all idea hype guys. And I think you, in your tortured effort to get to a joke, I really do think you hit on something there. Sorry, like I said, this brings the worst out of me. This is the Ed Goes Feral episode.
Ed is spicy tonight.
Well, it's also a Monday. I hate Mondays. But,
okay, Dilbert.
Garfield, thank you. But like, You did hit on something there where a lot of this is just sort of the fetid swamp of not doing anything. Like, this is the failure to accomplish, right? I would go a little further than the iPhone, but I am not the first person to say this, but the fact that all of these hucksters came out of cryptocurrency and then NFTs, which are cryptocurrency but different, and then are now screwing up a good thing with LLMs is just because they have a paucity of ideas. They don't know what they're doing. They're just talking about it, right? If you look at most of these things, they all follow the Facebook for cats formula of like the early 2010s, where now it's just X but with crypto, now X but with NFTs. Sorry, I shouldn't use the letter X. It has certain other associations these days. I need a new one. But like, yeah, they're just bolting AI onto it now. And they're just going to keep doing it because venture capital hasn't run out of money yet.
I flatly refuse to cede an entire letter of the alphabet to Elon Musk.
You're not wrong. I think it's like, what's the symbol called? I believe it is called, we can give him mathematical double struct capital X.
Yeah. Okay. Sold.
He
can fight Excel for it.
Yeah.
Are you talking about Chi?
Kai?
Did you just call it Chi?
I had a professor who called it Chi. No lie. I never know what the proper...
95% sure it's pronounced Kai. And I know this because the Kai Rho was the symbol that, you know...
Yes, I too have listened to the history of Byzantium podcast.
Yes. And the history of seriously. Rome. And the history of Rome. It wasn't just Byzantium.
That's true.
I have heard Chai, Kai, Chi, and Ki. And I have never known what the proper pronunciation is because I have not listened to the Byzantium podcast that you two perverts have gone on in on.
Well, now we're going to have an awkward silence about this, aren't we?
Yeah, because I'm looking up how to pronounce this. Yeah, it's pronounced Kai.
It's pronounced Kai.
Wait, also key? Come on.
What? No. Take it back.
Primary pronunciation is Kai, okay?
All right, we're going with Kai then.
I'm booking the dub. That's it. Yep.
Kai, the everything app.
Can I go home now?
We were talking a little bit about Denmark, and we're going to do it again, because tonight on Normal Men, we're going to do GLP-1 chat. GLP-1s are a peptide molecule that is a new, at this point, it's not actually that new, but a new treatment for weight loss. And the primary company behind the rise of GLP-1s has been Novo Nordisk, which is a fascinating company, a pharmaceutical company in Denmark. And so we're back to the Danes for tonight.
I do have a question. Did you lay out that cold open just to get to here? George, just say yes.
No, actually, because I didn't pick the cold open that we did.
No, I'm afraid I picked the cold open.
I will never assume better of you again, George.
Yeah. So anyhow, Novo Nordisk is interesting just before we focus on the actual drugs themselves. Novo Nordisk is interesting because it's entirely owned by, it's owned like basically 30% or 70%, 80% by a company that is entirely owned by the Novo Nordisk Foundation. So effectively, Novo Nordisk is owned by a foundation, which is not something that we're used to in the United States, to put it mildly. But it's a public company. You can go and buy shares of it in an American brokerage account. They have ADRs, or any European one if you're over there, whatever. And yeah, but you're the majority holder, and the super majority holder in terms of voting shares is a foundation that has a set of imperatives to go and do good in the world. So interesting stuff there. And they've done some good, actually, with GLP-1s.
This is a drug that this kind of ties into the NIHD funding. This entire class of drugs came out of some research that was being done into Gila monsters, those weird venomous lizards. And it turns out that they produce something that acts as an agonist to GLP receptors in the human body. And what that does is it interferes with the conversation that your brain and your gut are having. These drugs were initially rolled out to treat diabetes, but they noticed while they were treating diabetes with it that people kept losing large amounts of weight while taking the drug. And The mechanism for this is that it suppresses appetite. There may be other secondary mechanisms as well, but as someone who has tried two different GLP agonists and is on one currently, the big thing you notice is that it suppresses appetite.
We need to get somebody deeper into this on at some point, because I need to know what possessed somebody to go milk a Gila monster.
It was probably somebody at the zoo.
Dang, I got bit, but I haven't eaten in a week.
I think that this is a transformative class of drugs. I think that this, you know, we keep getting studies back on what both the older generations of these drugs do and what the newer and upcoming generations of these drugs do. And I keep waiting for there to be whammies in terms of there being some significant negative side effect, but everything is coming back aces, not just in terms of it causes weight loss, but it causes weight loss in ways that seem to affect obesity's comorbidities in the way you would want it to. Looks like it reduces heart disease. It's got some, at least to me, unexpected effects on some unexpected diseases. It may be that GLP-1 agonists are a solution for Parkinson's. There's some thought that this is going to have significant impact on Alzheimer's incidence. You know, these are, to my mind, looking like the great technological breakthrough of this decade, and I'm aware of AI.
Wow.
So
rip my joke.
Their ass. I think I can remember having a conversation with a friend of mine probably a couple years ago now, maybe a year and a half ago now, about GLP-1s. And he is someone who's been heavier his whole life, basically, and has had confidence issues from that. But otherwise, you know, generally he's happy with his lot, and he sees the rise of semaglutide and how widespread it's getting. And he's just like, you know, I can remember Fen-Phen. So if you're not aware, Fen-Phen was a 1990s weight loss drug that ended up causing significant cardiac issues, elevated heartbeat, high blood pressure, hypertension, so like really elevated blood pressure, and even heart valve problems. And there is a long history of similar drugs, right, where there is a social pressure to look a certain way, and the pharmaceutical compounds that people try and use to get there are generally pretty nasty. That does not appear to be the case in any way, shape, or form with GLP-1s. There are side effects, and certain compounds have different effects on different people, so you can get some pretty nasty side effects, actually, in some cases, and then you have to, you can't use that particular compound, obviously. But in terms of long-term side effects, we have very long-term safety studies with these things because they've been used for quite some time with patients that have diabetes, and nothing. If anything, the thing, as Proctor said, that they are discovering is that it's having wider than expected positive impact, with, as opposed to finding the ticking time bomb side effect under the hood down the line. Obviously, as with any long-term use of a compound, you need lots and lots of data and long, long time periods to be 100% absolutely sure. But as a Bayesian, if you're going through and updating your priors and adding new information, and Ed, I did that one just for you, buddy. I can see your face. If you're updating your priors and getting new information and saying, okay, what do we think now that we have this new information? Everything's come through looking better than we thought it would a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago.
It just keeps finding new stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it might reduce alcohol cravings. Sure, why not? Tracks.
Without getting too deep in the weeds on this, the history of weight loss drugs, as George alluded to, has been one that's included a lot of peril. Some of that is because historically, most of the weight loss drugs have been, you know, did you invent a new weight loss drug, or is it methamphetamine? Well, it's methamphetamine. Fen-Phen was notably not that. I think Fen-Phen is really the nightmare scenario for these GLP agonists, where you have a serious side effect that doesn't show up in sufficient quantity in your medical trials, but that is very observable. And with fen-phen, as with GLP-1 agonists, you get a lot of gray market use. So because of that social pressure and because lots of people are very interested in losing weight, you get use cases that are outside of, you know, the full medical supervision, let's do everything right use case. People are going to take too much of these drugs. People are going to use these drugs in ways that you do not anticipate in your trial. Different categories of people are going to take these drugs than you trialed on. And so there's really a high bar for safety for this kind of stuff. It's not as if you are treating very sick people under intense medical supervision, the way that if you were, for instance, talking about something that is a cancer drug, you might be. You're not seeing people use, you know, the same drugs that we use for chemotherapy recreationally or socially.
Well, maybe actually the Yarvin crowd, maybe.
No, that's true. Actually,
if you can pronounce the drugs they're on, they're not cool enough anymore.
Yeah, no, those guys are very into Russian research chemicals from the 60s. But as somebody who has been involved professionally with some of the history of these kinds of medications, this is one that I have been watching this family for a while, waiting for a whammy, because at some point there's going to be a study that this increases some cancer incidence, or that it does something bad to you. There is going to be significant liability associated with these, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a bad idea to take the drug. It just means that there's going to be legally actionable liability associated with them.
The way that you kind of went A to B there, I was a little worried you were going to say professional relationship with Russian research chemicals. But no. Like to your point, I'm just going to say it. You were assuming something there. You were assuming that that's going to happen. And sure, it's quite possible, but like this stuff has a really long longitudinal existence already.
I don't know, Ed. I got a lot of faith in the litigiousness of the American legal system.
You know, fair, but
I got to be honest, buddy. There doesn't take much thin edge to get that word in there.
Look, are we talking about real things? Or are we talking about Homer Simpson gets a bug up his ass?
We're talking about litigation risk, which is not the same. Which is not the same, right, as a public health deal.
I'm still exactly. stuck on y'all bringing up fen-phen and like transferring back to when I was like 14. And my mom ran a cardiology practice when the whole fen-phen thing was going on. Yeah.
Oof. Pretty good for cardiologists.
Yeah.
You know, fen-phen was kind of amazing. It's rare that you do find a drug that's worse than methamphetamines.
The thing with fen-phen is it went from no use to extremely widespread use so quickly.
Right.
That there wasn't really a lag time in there for people to figure out that, hey, there were these serious cardiac risks. And, you know, that's a problem. The fact that we had this kind of time-lagged cushion of experience with diabetics taking the larger family of GLP-1 agonists makes this a different situation. We'll see whether or not it's enough of a different situation. I mean, I do think that there are still potentially time bombs out there. I don't want to be a Pollyanna about this, but essentially every study that's come back has come back not just good, but great.
Yeah. And just to give people an idea of the sort of timelines we're talking about here, Ozempic was approved in 2017. There are other GLP-1 agonists that have been on the market since as early as 2005. Right. So this stuff is the broad category of molecules is not new, and there is enormous amounts of clinical data on it because, I mean, if something's approved in 2017, that means it's been under study for probably a decade plus before that. Maybe not a decade, kind of depends, but somewhere between a decade and half a decade before that. So we've been putting this stuff into people's arms, not literally arms, but I guess tummies, for what, 10 plus years now. If you go to Byetta, I think was the first one in 2005, 20 years of data of one kind or another.
I would say it's about a decade at some kind of scale. And at this point, we have enough of a track record with semaglutide directly that it's starting to get up there. We're talking about semaglutide. We're talking, we will talk about tirzepatide and retatrutide. There's a bunch of different drugs in this family. One of the kind of interesting things economically about these drugs is that because there are a bunch of different molecules that do pretty much the same thing, it's an unusual IP situation. There's less of a moat than there might otherwise be because there are a bunch of different similars that are owned by different companies that can get you to the same result. And it's been kind of interesting to see the progress of that because despite the fact that there are a bunch of different drugs that do this very desirable thing, things have really channeled into so far two different of these molecules because they're the ones that got the first regulatory approval. It's channeled in first semaglutide, which is, as George said, the Novo Nordisk drug that is fueling Ozempic and Wegovy and Rybelsus, I think, is the name of their oral formulation.
Yeah, that's the oral one.
Rybelsus is the oral, and Ozempic is the Rybelsus is for diabetes oral. Ozempic is for diabetes injectable, and then Wegovy is for obesity, or I don't know how I pronounce it, Wegovy, I don't know, for obesity. So, yeah. And then the tirzepatide, you may be familiar with brand names like Mounjaro or Zepbound. They're manufactured by Eli Lilly. They were approved in 2022. Very similar molecule.
Go America.
We're number two.
Well, I mean, so it's a better drug than semaglutide, in my opinion. It's a better drug with it's the next generation, right? Like it's got a greater clinical effect on weight loss. It does more for your diabetes markers. And for me personally, and we'll talk a little bit more about my personal experience with these, the side effects are considerably less. So there was always going to be a process as we sort of iterated through these, figuring out how to make these drugs better. And it's happened very quickly over the past few years that we've gone from semaglutide, which was a fairly rudimentary, just kind of hitting the mechanism on the side with a wrench. and it turns out it appears that it's a really important mechanism. So it's a useful thing to do to hit it with a wrench. These later generation drugs add in cocktails of other things that work in concert with the great wrenching of your GLP-1 agonists that mediate or enhance that in some ways. That's giving us better results with Tirza, and it appears from the trials to be giving us better results with Reta, which is the next generation Eli Lilly drug that hopefully is going to get approval sometime the next year.
So Proctor, do you want to tell us about your experience with these drugs personally in terms of how that's gone for you? Both as a patient and, you know, what it was like to get access to them. Cause I mean, they weren't widely available until relatively recently for a lot of people, and indications have been changing quickly. So, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, if you were connected to the right prestige doctors, you could get off-label prescriptions for Ozempic as a treatment to lose weight, even though that was meant for diabetes. To be clear, Wegovy is the same thing. It just wasn't prescribed for that. Now you can get Wegovy if you're overweight, but you know, so did you have any access issues with that, or did you get on the train late enough that hasn't been a problem?
Yeah. So, I mean, I got interested in this, I want to say it was probably 2021, 2022. I could look up the dates if it's important, and decided that I wanted to check out semaglutide, and, you know, kind of in the spirit of inquiry, like I think a lot of people, I put on some weight during the pandemic and I didn't care for it. Efforts to change diet and exercise had not met with a great deal of success. So I talked to my doctor about it, my GP, and he said, okay, you know, I'll write you a prescription. You figure out how to fill it. And I got Ozempic from a Canadian mail order pharmacy I paid about $300 a month for that. And it was name brand Ozempic. There's also compounding pharmacies, which we'll talk about in a little bit. You know, this was Novo Nordisk product and the Novo Nordisk injector. And you had this little pen that you dialed up the amount that you were putting in your body. So you had a fair amount of control over dosage. And I was on that for about 9 months, over the course of which I lost about 40 pounds. And there was a clear plateau effect there. I want to say that I lost almost all of that weight in the first 6 months. And then I was just kind of hanging out there. I eventually decided to go off of semaglutide because I was pretty miserable on it. I just felt tired, exhausted all the time. There were also, you know, the sulfur burps are a phrase you probably haven't thought about if you haven't taken a GLP-1. It's an evocative phrase. It does exactly what it sounds like. And they're a side effect of a lot of these because it changes the way it changes the speed at which your stomach processes food. And through some alchemy I do not fully understand, that results in you burping sulfur. That was an unpleasant side effect I had a lot of on semaglutide, and there were various other gastric effects as well that were not all that fun. But the big one for me was the fatigue. I just felt like hammered crap all the time. And so I decided, and this is, you know, obviously people have made different decisions about this particular tension point, that it was not worth it to me to stay on the drug indefinitely at that level of quality of life, because I wasn't getting enough. I was taking this drug for quality of life, and I didn't feel I was getting enough out of the weight loss to justify the side effects. I'm a reasonably large white dude, and there's less pressure on me to be thin than there is for many other combinations of race and gender. Other people have made different decisions there, and that's great. I'm basically pro-body self-modification. But for me, it wasn't worth it to stay on semaglutide. So I went off, and I kind of put that in the back pocket because it was clear that this was a category of drugs that had a significant effect on my weight. Experientially, it was kind of interesting. There were a lot of things about the way that I interacted with food that I had assumed were just, you know, me, that, and, you know, I guess they were still just me, but they were mediated or modified by being on these drugs to the extent that they were no longer recognizable as me. Just, you know, prior to this, I finished my plate, you know, portion control was a problem, and I had some kind of psychological relationship to food issues that just vanished on this stuff. You put this under your skin, and you don't think about food anymore. It's not, you know, you're no longer grazing on snacks that are out on the table. Walk away from half a beer. You can walk away from half a plate of food in a way that I couldn't psychologically before, or at least didn't psychologically before. I think I probably could have forced myself to.
I've always had trouble with that, the clean your plate thing. Like, if there's food in front of me, I'll pretty much eat it. I mean, I go through cycles with this too. Like, I haven't tried the semaglutides, but I'm right now about as light as I've been since college, and 95% of it is just eating less. Like, just, and the, you know, I can do it, but it does sound pretty nice to just be able to hit an easy button for it.
No, I mean, it's great. Like, it's that part experientially was, at least for me, fantastic, and was really freeing in a lot of ways to say, okay, well, you know, maybe this is me, but it's a part of me that's super modifiable by chemicals.
You parentheses stomach.
Yeah. Yeah. So like whatever subsystem is responsible for this behavior for me, this is one that I have chemical mastery over, and therefore maybe I no longer need to think of that as part of the core package. And, you know, I mean, like, there were some other downsides in terms of kind of dopamine systems. Like I couldn't drink hoppy beer anymore. Like, hops particularly, that bitterness was really repellent to me.
Hmm. Which you shouldn't do anyway.
True. Proctor's over here saying you can leave half a beer, and I'm like, oh, that's easy.
You can leave your Mumford and Sons IPA.
Well, like, I mean, so I'm a drinker. I wouldn't describe myself as a huge drinker, but I'm a drinker. And prior to being on semaglutide, put it this way, the modal number of beers I would drink was not one. I could drink zero beers, and I could drink three beers, but I was not drinking one beer. And while on semaglutide, it was very, very easy for me to have a beer.
I do think the link between alcohol and food is, you know, you mentioned that it reduced your craving for alcohol, or the data that suggests it could be very beneficial to alcoholics. I really get that. We'll talk about this at another point, what drove this on this podcast, but I've had to cut back my drinking quite radically to the point where I have one, maybe two beers or alcoholic drinks. That's it. And if I do that, it's like once, maybe twice a week. It's really, really toned down compared to where I was even late last year. And not consuming those liquid calories, and also just not consuming alcohol has really dulled appetite for me in a way that I would never have predicted. I mean, obviously I knew beforehand, like if I'm drinking beer, that's again, liquid calories. I understand how thermodynamics works. Like I get it. If I'm drinking a lot more beer, I'm consuming a lot more calories. So that's going to keep my weight heavier, but it's had a direct impact on my appetite. And again, this has nothing to do with GLP-1s. It's just those two things I think are connected in a way that I, you know, it never would have occurred to me that getting into that mode of drinking less would make me less hungry and also want to drink less.
That's interesting, because like for me, drinking makes me stop eating. Always has. Don't know why.
Huh. Same with me.
But the weird thing is I stopped really drinking because I lost a lot of weight. Because suddenly one drink and I'm like, no, I'm done. Right? Like in my 20s, like I was up around like 270 at one point, and then I lost like 50 pounds doing keto. Thing works. Mm-hmm. Turns out you keep it off too, even after you allow the goodness of pasta back into your life. But yeah, couldn't drink anymore, which was kind of unfortunate because then it's like, oh, well, you know, a whiskey neat is less calories than, you know, an alarming number of chips. But it's weird how differently it works for just about everybody.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that also speaks to some of the paranoia that folks have. I mean, I'll use myself. I'll not put this on some invented person. Like, you know, my prior is that our bodies are extremely, extremely complicated machines. And when you, to use Propter's term, start whacking the side of the machine with a novel molecule, you'll probably be able to get what you want done, but it's easy to see how that would create side effects down the road, you know, because it's a very complex system. When you do unpredictable stuff to complex systems, it's like slapping tariffs on a very large economy, or a large developed economy, right? Like maybe it'll be fine, but you're hitting a very complicated machine pretty hard in a way that it's not supposed to, we're not really designed to be hit. Maybe, I don't know, designed. But so my prior would be that, yeah, I mean, we should be careful with this stuff because who knows what long-term use. And again, updating, we haven't seen any evidence that it's actually causing problems. Chemical mastery over our bodies is, I think, kind of scary for people to conceptualize, but in some senses is very true. It's what modern medicine is, right?
I mean, forget chemical. I'm going to go have a laser lance into both of my eyes next month.
Great example. Right?
I'm getting ICLs put in because my eyes are too bad for LASIK. Very expensive discovery. But yeah, like I don't know. I have been in that boat forever. I've wanted LASIK for a very long time, but like my eyes wouldn't stop doing the thing, and then finally it's like, oops, how about we just shove a contact lens in there permanently? Which is good because I hate regular contacts. I have definitely been looking at the GLP-1 type stuff, by which I mean there is a pack in my freezer fridge that I haven't opened because I hate needles. Like literally, it's been sitting there for 4 months. I hate needles. And at some point, I need to get over that. Let's stare at the laser first is kind of where I'm at.
I mean, the good news is that if long-term side effects do pop up and y'all folks have to get off the GLP-1s, they're still smoking.
Camel Crush is for everybody, baby.
Camel Crush is for everybody. You can all come back and join me in the good place.
Though the genuinely funny thing, not that I'm ignoring that horrific suggestion of joining you and the good Golokel machine in certain things, I have been taking hair drugs since I was 21. So it's like, this isn't new. This is just keeping on going. This I get a little help.
Ed's hair looks good, by the way. You guys should understand that.
It does look good. It's orange, which is unfortunate, but
it's not normally this orange. That's also related to the magenta. Cameras are hard, folks. But yeah, like, I've been taking that since I was like 22, and I have more hair than anyone in my family has had in generations. Turns out science works sometimes.
Yeah. And I think there is a fundamentally hostile view to the idea of human agency when we say people shouldn't be allowed to change who they are through outside means.
Cheat outlandishly, do it. It's fine. It's your call.
Yeah. I mean, I say that with like, you can take that thought too far. Like, I don't even think a blue sky leftist is like the good faux, like the good made up person for this, but like a Twitter leftist, I think this is more their thing, where like any effort to prevent people from doing whatever they want to their bodies is like some sort of Nazi plot. That's not true, because, you know, there are lots of people out there that would seek to take advantage of those right. that want to modify their bodies. And we need to make sure that those people are not able to do that.
Yeah. I mean, informed consent is a thing,
you know? Yeah. So, you know, I don't want to go too far down this path, but like, as long as it's not hurting someone else, and as long as it's not, you know, something that's taking advantage of you, then go nuts. Like, it's your body.
Right. I mean, I think we're on the same page here, that the reason for me to oppose that kind of thing is because of fraud and longitudinal risk, rather than because they're repugnant transactions.
100%. That's exactly.
Yeah. And like, one of the places where I find myself kind of diverging a little from the internet mainstream, I guess, is like, I don't care what that billionaire Brian Johnson does. Sure, whatever. I think it's weird. Maybe we'll learn something. Maybe we won't. Who cares? It's his money.
Is that the hyper aging guy?
That's the guy.
See,
is he probably a kook? Sure, but like, I'd rather him doing that than being in the group chats talking about the fall of Western society.
Yes, I'll agree with you up until the point where he was like swapping blood with his son, which I think was like a little much.
That's a little, it's weird. I'm not saying it's not.
He was also measuring he and his son's erections.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
That's a bit much.
That's a lot. Should there be a law against that? Maybe not, but really.
Yes.
You get into kind of like power dynamics there that maybe do create repugnant transactions.
Yeah, like there is always a point at which this can go over the line.
If you don't stop him now, he might become Speaker of the House.
I think when the phrase "blood boy" enters the conversation, that's a red flag that you've at least tiptoed up to the line and you know, not necessarily that it's a repugnant transaction. I think people should be able to sell their blood if they want to, but that heightened scrutiny is justified.
No, totally.
Anyway, to get back to my favorite topic, meat. After the FDA approved Zepbound for the treatment of obstructive sleep apnea, which I also have, I sleep with a mask like Bane, I was able to get my insurance to cover it, which is great. So I decided, okay, you know, had a good positive effect from this class of drugs last time. Let's try it again and let's see whether or not the side effects are as bad on this generation as they were on the last generation. So I went on Zepbound about 6 months ago, and I've lost 50 pounds in that time, gone from about 275 pounds to about 225. And it's just, and I stuck the weight loss graph in a group chat the other day, but like, it's absolutely linear. It's just a straight drop. I felt a little weird about posting that because it feels like faked stats. Like it should be jumpier and it's not. It's just been, you know, monotonic, about a pound and a half a week, pound and a half, 2 pounds, something like that.
But like, that makes total sense, right? Like it's how many calories are coming in, right? I assume your calories out are probably pretty consistent. And it's, if it is roughly like a linear, you know, like a coefficient on how much you eat, then it's just going to scale everything down and you're going to just be straight line.
Yeah. Well, I mean, other people have had different experiences with it, so I don't know if linear weight loss is necessarily what you'd expect.
Sure. I mean, like, I'm sure everyone responds to it slightly differently.
Just for context, like a pound and a half a week is roughly 4,500 calories, like an imbalance in calories of 3,000 calories per pound of fat is rule of thumb. Everybody's metabolism works slightly different, but if you put human fat under a microscope or into a calorie meter, that's what you get out. So that works out to like 650 calories a day, give or take, which is a medium-sized sandwich, you know, something like that, which doesn't sound like all that much, but when it's consistent over time, makes a huge difference. And yeah, I mean, Proctor, how do you feel now versus 6 months ago?
Lighter. No, I mean, it's nice. It's nice. I feel better about my body. I'm definitely lighter. My wind is better. I feel like, it's easier for me to move and do things because I'm 50 pounds lighter. All of that's nice.
So you're going to come play in a soccer tournament with me soon?
Maybe. No, I'm terrible.
Oh, I am too. No. The skill level isn't what we're looking for here.
But yeah, no, it's freeing. And I think that if if you go into kind of the corners of the internet where people are talking about their personal experiences with GLP drugs, like there's a very consistent story that gets told. Like you see these people physically transform before and after pictures. It's clear that they are getting treated differently and that they feel differently about themselves because we stigmatize obesity in a lot of ways in this culture, in a lot of ways, great and small. And, you know, without engaging on the merits of whether that's wise, whether that's a good practice, it's absolutely a practice that exists. You know, I haven't had that kind of dramatic transformation, but physically I feel better. And the side effects on Zepbound for me have been significantly less than the side effects on semaglutide. That, you know, I don't have the same level of feeling like crap all the time. I do have some gastric side effects that aren't great, but for me, this is a worthwhile deal, where semaglutide was not a worthwhile deal.
So more sulfur, or are we picking a different periodic element?
Not zero sulfur burps, but way fewer sulfur burps on Zepbound. For me personally, again, different people have different reactions to these drugs.
So a little bit of ode to egg.
Yeah, just a okay. Little bit.
You merely adopted the sulfur. I was born into it, molded by it.
Anyway, insurance covers it. So, you know, I'm paying $25 a month copay for my Zepbound, and that's
hell yeah. Great.
There are a number of gray market ways, at least for now, that people are accessing these drugs, including accessing retatrutide, which is the one that isn't FDA approved yet. There are compounding pharmacies that will sell you pretty much whatever you want in China and in India. I think the domestic ones are getting wound down at this point.
Yep. Hims and Hers was a really popular one, and they're in the process of winding down. Even Weight Watchers had a compounding pharmacy attached to it, which is kind of wild, but I think they're winding that one down as well. The FDA had basically a grace period through May was when you were sort of supposed to start getting things wound up, and they're still selling some stuff, I think, here and there, but it's basically winding down as far as the domestic ones. But if you go on the internet,
yeah.
What I would say is, if you're listening to this and you're considering doing compounding stuff, I mean, we're not going to tell you what to do, but I would be very hesitant to put something inside my body that wasn't at least FDA approved.
Yeah.
I would just say that. It's your body, not mine, but wait for safety data.
The other thing about this is if there is eventually litigation about this, again, I think eventually there is going to be litigation in some form, because we have a gigantic sample.
We have lawyers.
Yeah, and I flatly refuse to believe that there's no negative impact that this stuff has on you. I think the positive impacts outweigh the negative impacts greatly, but the way litigation works is you don't test the positive impacts against the negative impacts for whether or not there's an actionable case. You say, is there a negative impact that you didn't tell me about? And if so, then you go file a lawsuit about it. I would be surprised if we get through a longitudinal course of this with there being no increase in any cancer incidence, no increase in any kind of long-term digestive malady, which again, you know, I'm taking the drug. I intend to continue taking the drugs. I think they're a good deal overall, but if you're going through a compounding pharmacy, you're going to get shut out of that litigation. If you're going through the official product, you're going to be part of it. So that's a consideration long-term. Also, just from a, you know, purity standpoint, what you're putting in your body, it's probably best to try to stick to the official stuff as much as you can. That said, the price difference between the official stuff and the compounding stuff, the gray market stuff, is extreme.
It also depends on, like, what you're doing for compounding. Like, if you're just one person going to a website, that's a lot different than, like, I know a lot of people who do this stuff at this mm-hmm. point, because, yeah, like, my insurance doesn't cover it. It's $1,000 a month. What a lot of folks I know do is they do a bulk buy and then they engage a independent testing, like on their own. And that seems to work out very well for them, right? Like absolutely zero issues.
That's really smart.
Yeah. Like, and I mean, these are all tech people, right? Like they're all nerds. Of course they're going to do this. And like the outcomes for them have been, you know, random sampling out of the vials. One person generally handles the distribution, all that stuff, which, you know, leave it to someone who has more letters after their name than me for the legal concerns there. But from a practical perspective, it does seem like there are routes, because one of the things that seems like the most difficult to wrap one's arms around is that, like, people breaking news want this, right? And it's not a complicated drug to make.
Right.
And that's going to be ever more challenging because, like, at some point, you're not, obviously, not under this administration, but, like, you start going, hey, when does somebody just buy you out, right? Like, when does somebody decide you don't get to make hideous profit on this off everybody anymore? And, yeah, there's a patent system. So, there's also a lot of people on the other side of it who will vote for anyone who says yes. So, like, there's a lot of unknown unknowns on something that is quite that transformative. Because, like, the only other thing that I know of that I can think of that is in that ballpark is something like statins. Because statins were a huge change for a ton of people. Also, they're 2 months older than me. So, yeah. Insulin?
Insulin?
Insulin's up there for sure. And insulin's also, like, that might even be a better case, just in the sense that, like, anyone can make it. Sorry, that's a little flip, but I guess not everyone can make it, sorry. but like, the drug, like, it is not difficult at all to synthesize insulin from that perspective, and that's why, like, the market price for it is cheap.
Lotax, do you synthesize insulin in your back porch?
Yeah, absolutely, all the time.
Yeah,
it's what the copper still is for.
I'm always saying this.
Listen, I'm the one in bootlegging country.
Look, I'll level with you. Once you get down south of where Propter is, you are just a mass of banjos.
So, I mean, I think that the market for the compounding stuff on this speaks to some of the somewhat weird economics about this looking forward as a pharmaceutical. Because of the multiplicity of molecules that do this that I mentioned, there's even some hope within the IP system for competitor drugs. It's something of a mystery to me why regulators have not pursued trying to get more competition on the market, because these drugs are not that expensive to make.
Are there that many of them in the pipeline? I've never looked.
There's like, well, I don't actually know where they are in the pipeline now, but there's something like eight different things like Tirza and like Sema that are these base GLP-1 inhibitors that are owned by different people, and they think they can crank out another half dozen of them if they want to. And they have, you know, different profiles. There's a reason that things converged on semaglutide, because the trials on that were the most attractive of the first batch.
It's still wild to me that, like, Eli Lilly announced that new one, Attain One, having, like, slightly below average, below expected returns in their phase 3 trial, and then didn't their stock price just take a header?
Yeah, they were down, like, 12% or 13%. They then reported really good earnings a little bit after that, so it kind of got lost in the wash. But, like, yeah, pre-market, they were down over 10%. And the results for Attain One, which... Orfaglipirin is how you say the actual name, Orfaglipirin. They reported an 11.2% average weight loss, which is, this is an oral GLP-1. So it's Eli Lilly's oral medication as opposed to injecting yourself. And that 11.2% average weight loss is pretty impressive, right? I mean, if you're talking about someone that's 200 pounds losing 20 pounds, that's a lot of weight.
I will go give them as much money as they want right now. And I'm yes.
Yeah. for context, that's about 75% as big as the injectables get on average. So it's very close, and it's oral, and yet the stock still got hit pretty hard. Novo Nordisk has gotten smoked for the past few years because they had this amazing run of sales growth, and they're now starting to cut guidance. So they cut guidance back at the end of July. They'd expected a sales growth holding exchange rates constant between 13% and 21% this year, and they cut it to 8% to 14%. So the midpoint went from 16% to 9%, or sorry, 11%, which, you know, that's a big cut. And it's because there's just so many alternatives proliferating. There's so much compounding going on. There's a bunch of ways to do this, and they can only get so much stuff through their distribution model.
I mean, Eli Lilly's made a better drug, and it looks like Eli Lilly is about to is about to release a second better drug. There are currently, I just looked this up, there are currently 7 different GLP-1 agonists that have been approved by regulatory agencies.
For weight loss or just in general?
Most of these have been approved only for diabetes.
Gotcha.
3 of them have been approved for weight loss. Liraglutide is the one that we aren't talking about that's been approved since 2010. That's not as good for weight loss for various reasons. Anyway, in addition to those, there's a bunch more of these that are theoretically makeable that might have attractive properties, or even if they don't have attractive properties chemically, they might have the attractive property of not being under patent by Novo Nordisk or Eli Lilly. So there's the space for some competition in this drug class that I think is going to be really interesting to see how it plays out, because you have the interaction of a bunch of different big mechanisms at some point. And as this is probably going to happen, unfortunately, under the Trump presidency, at some point, Medicare is going to have to make a call on how it approaches these. And it's not obvious to me what they're going to do or when they're going to do it. It would be tremendously expensive to put everybody obese on these at the full freight rate. But obviously, you know, these things can be produced for as cheap as a couple of bucks a dose.
And that's now. I mean,
you also get into the funny logic too of where if you subsidize a drug like this, you're extending lifespan and actually raising cost over time, right, on an aggregate basis.
But then you have the third hand of what other costs are you also reducing at the same time? It's weird.
Yeah. Just from the narrow perspective of the Medicare program though, right?
Yeah, totally. Like,
yeah. Hopefully we will not have the other shoe drop in terms of bad clinical outcomes. That's, you know, I think anyone would agree that whether you think that'll happen or not, you would hope it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And if we don't have that happen, I mean, I do think it's a remarkable story of supporting human flourishing, right? I've struggled with my self-perception and like how I look and how I feel about how I look and how other people think about how I look my basically whole life. And the idea that I could take a prescription to make a huge impact on that without having to, you know, go through the hard work of coming to terms with myself as a 35-year-old man, you know, over time and with my insecurities and sort of living with that's pretty amazing. And I would want that for anybody, you know, whether I engage in it or not, right? I don't think I'll probably ever take this class of drugs, but if someone could avoid some of the pain and some of the social anxiety and some of the self-doubt that I went through over the course of my life because of these drugs, that's awesome. And I'm super happy for that person. And I hope they get the chance to do that.
I was just looking up because you're saying, you know, I'll likely never take them. And apparently there was a study earlier this year that GLP agonist use is associated with a decreased risk of prostate cancer. So like we are fully in floor wax and dessert topping territory. Who can even say?
Yeah. I just meant for their current prescribed.
Yes, but I wanted to prove you wrong, and that's an important part of this.
Congrats, Menchus.
Vicious.
Magenta Menchus, they're calling me.
One of these days I'm going to actually like fix the camera so you can't say that.
Brutal.
It's not gonna be today.
That's our show for this week. If you wouldn't mind rating or reviewing us in the podcast app you're listening to Normal Men on, we sure would appreciate that. For Normal Men, I'm George in Charlotte.
From DC, I'm Propter.
From outer Florida, I'm Low Tax Speed Run Enjoyer.
And I'm Ed from Boston.
Stay normal, y'all.